Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 12, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss constitutional challenges to the America Invents Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome to our call today four experts, one of whom will be moderating. I'm going to simply introduce our moderator, and he'll introduce the other guests today. They're going to have some discussion among themselves, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. Our moderator today is Mr. Trevor K. Copeland. He's the shareholder at Brinks, Gilson, and Leone, and he is also, importantly, a longtime member of the Leadership Committee of the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group. With that, Trevor.
Greetings and welcome this afternoon. I'm looking forward to a good discussion regarding the America Invents Act, and particularly some lessons that we've learned after a few years of experience with the Patent Trials and Appeal Board, the PTAB. My practice is as a patent attorney with the Chicago office of Brinks, Gilson, and Leone, which is currently a national, soon-to-be international firm, as we're going to be opening in China later this year or early next year. I'll be serving as a moderator, introducing our panelists and topics. Since you've tuned in to hear from our speakers and not about us, I'll just be providing a short introduction, and you can do a web search for any of us if you want to learn more about our respective practices, professional failures, successes, or other adventures. Our first panelist will be Robert Greenspoon. Rob is a founding member of Flox Barton Greenspoon. He's a patent attorney who concentrates his practice on trial and appeal of patent cases and other complex litigations. Notable for this call, he represents the appellant Cooper in the pending Cooper versus Lee Supreme Court case. He will be discussing the original justification for the AIA and presenting a war story or two about PTAB practice by way of providing some practical illustration regarding issues with implementation. Following Rob, Adam Mossoff will be speaking. Adam is a professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, where he's also the director and a senior scholar at the Center for the Protection of Intellectual Property. Adam will be discussing constitutional protection accorded to patents as private property rights, or the lack thereof, in PTAB proceedings. Adam has long been interested in and had experience with this, including testimony before Congress back before the AIA was adopted. He's also authored a number of amicus briefs for AIA-related appeals. Our final speaker, before we open the line for your questions, will be Tejinder Singh. He practices with Goldstein and Russell, where he represents parties and amici before the Supreme Court and lower courts, including a 2014 win in the Supreme Court case of Lane versus Franks, which established that the First Amendment does protect subpoenaed testimony of public employees. He currently represents the appellant MCM in the pending MCM versus HP Supreme Court case that relates to today's topic. By way of introduction, I note we have nearly 4 years of data from the PTAB, which replaced the old Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences as part of applying the AIA's new laws and procedures. On the positive side, practitioners and those operating in the patent field generally have noted that this does provide a means for testing and challenging claims of issued patents that's both faster and less expensive than district courts in most cases. Depending on whether you're a patentee or an accused infringer, this could be viewed as a pro or a con in any given case. Those of us in practice and in the academy who have higher level structural concerns with the role of patents for innovation and economic growth appreciate the need to kill so-called bad patents, patents that were not well examined and or that suffer from other infirmities, particularly those that are being abusively enforced, for example, by leveraging the high costs of patent litigation against unsophisticated defendants who may opt for the certainty of capitulation over risking multi-million dollar litigation expenses of a full district court trial. However, as our panel will discuss today, the deck does seem to be stacked against patentees in view of the law, procedural rules, and other implementation aspects at the PTAB. I'm not personally aware of statistically relevant studies regarding hard numbers for patent applications post-AIA by particular technologies or directed to particular commercial monetary value criteria of various products and methods. However, my sense personally from speaking around the country with corporate counsel, private practitioners, and with corporate and private inventors and investors is that there is a chilling effect. That is, people are losing faith in the ability of the U.S. patent system effectively to protect his or her inventions with patents. Some hard numerical data that are available posted by the U.S. Patent Office will provide some background color for today's discussion. For example, as of July, only 7 petitions to amend claims have actually been granted during PTAB trials. This is out of over 5,200 petitions that have been filed under the AIA's rules since it was implemented through June 30th of 2016. That's the most recently posted data. Most of these are inter partes reviews. Others are under covered business methods and post-grant review petitions. Within those instituted actions, over half of the claims challenged where a PTAB trial was instituted have been invalidated. Only about 10% have been found patentable by the PTAB in a final written decision that actually subjects challengers to some type of estoppel, with about another 28% found patentable but not subject to that final written decision that firms up the patent holder's rights. In short, the as-applied odds are less than 50-50 for a patentee to keep his or her claims alive, less in some technologies, more in others, only about 10% overall with the application of estoppel against challengers, specifically with regard to arguments that were or reasonably should have been raised during their PTAB trial, which leaves open the door to future challenges and ostensibly weakens these patents. Interestingly, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has generally been deferential to the PTAB, even when, for example, in the Baxter versus Fresenius case, the substantive holding was inconsistent with the Federal Circuit's own prior opinion regarding validity of claims. Now, against that current snapshot of affairs, I'll turn it over to Rob for a discussion of how and why we got the AIA with some more color on how it's being applied.
Well, thank you, Trevor. I'm Rob Greenspoon at Flucksburg Greenspoon, and I wanted to thank you, Trevor, and thank the Federalist Society for giving me this platform. I have a self-imposed limit of about 6 minutes, so I'll do my very best. I might speak a little bit faster than I would if I were giving an argument in court, but I will go into somewhat more detail than just the purpose of the AIA and inter partes review, et cetera, since you know, we can say that in a few words. The purpose was to have a faster, cheaper way perceived to be better than what came before to determine administratively the patent validity disputes that pop up in litigation and other contexts. So I have the privilege, really, as I see it, of discussing what I'm calling the prehistory of the AIA, which is really important to understand. And my colleagues will talk about the constitutional issues directly, but you really can't grasp the full weight of the constitutional questions unless you see where we've been and how we got here. So among the panelists, I think I'm also the one who's appeared before the PTAB, so I can share some direct experience about what it's like being in front of a panel of what we call APJs, administrative patent judges. So moving on to the substance, I've called the prehistory of the AIA as a game of congressional Jenga. I don't know if the listeners are familiar with that game, but Jenga is that game where you sequentially remove rods from a tower, and I think the person loses who causes the tower to fall by removing the rod that was holding everything up. And from my perspective, what I've talked and written about is that we keep removing the structural rods that made prior regimes more defensible under the Constitution. And here, our story starts not in 1980 with ex parte reexamination, but actually a little bit before. So it turns out, and I'm borrowing liberally from a law review article from 1982 and the following statements, but from 1898 until 1977, the Patent Office relied on a case known as McCormick Harvesting versus Altman as authority for its view, the Patent Office's view, that it lacked jurisdiction over an issued patent and it would not consider or comment on an issued patent's validity. And during that period, the perception was that only federal courts would or could make statements that passed on the validity of a patent. And in fact, there's even a 1974 Commissioner of Patents decision which says exactly that. So something happened in 1977, but it was really just the camel's nose under the tent, as we later learned in looking at it in hindsight, which was there was a new director of the Patent Office called Commissioner Dan. Commissioner Dan sponsored or was the force behind some amendments that allowed from 1977 to 1982 via regulations within the Patent Office, this is not Congress, but via regulations in the Patent Office, they allowed contested reissue proceedings. So a patent owner would file a reissue application, and for a very short time, 5 years or so, you know, they were dabbling in the idea of oppositional proceedings in the Patent Office. So that was the Dan Amendments, 1977 to 1982. Ex parte reexamination was the first congressional step in the direction of allowing administrative challenges to the validity of issued patents in the Patent Office. And what's significant here in my mind, hopefully we'll hear a little bit more about this, is that initially there was de novo review in district courts of ex parte reexamination outcomes. Now, the ex parte reexam was a proceeding between the Patent Office and the applicant. The applicant would typically file his own request, or a third party could do so as well. But whatever the outcome, you could basically sue the Patent Office in a brand new federal court proceeding as in order to get review of whatever happened in the Patent Office. But then in 1985, someone had challenged the constitutionality of ex parte reexamination. And we'll hear a little bit more about this later, I'm sure, but the decision that the Federal Circuit issued in an opinion authored by Judge Newman was one called Patlex v. Mossinghoff. And in 1985, they purported, or Judge Newman in her written opinion, purported to distinguish this McCormick Harvesting versus Altman case on grounds that have later been, you know, analyzed by commentators as really inaccurate. Namely, McCormick Harvesting was held not to bar ex parte reexamination proceedings under the Constitution on the grounds that we were correcting a governmental mistake, whereas reissue proceedings were there to correct an applicant's voluntarily disclosed mistake. So the basis for distinguishing McCormick was the idea that we were correcting a governmental mistake, and that's why McCormick Harvesting didn't apply. But I hope we'll hear a little bit about how that actually flies right against the line of cases that led to McCormick Harvesting. Now, then the next thing to happen in the congressional landscape was something called inter partes reexamination. Again, it's still a proceeding between examiners and the applicant, but it's something like the Dan Amendments in the sense that opposers or alleged infringers could participate and actually could provoke these inter partes reexaminations, so they were adversarial. And what's also key is they were born without any de novo review. And in fact, in 1999, when they were born, they simultaneously revoked de novo trial court review from the purview of ex parte reexamination. So I'm probably running out of time, but I just want to reflect on the congressional history of ex parte reexamination. It's a common misperception that ex parte reexamination was built and designed for alleged infringers to use as a tool to get out from underneath the scope of a patent or to try to get an administrative finding of invalidity. But in fact, I'll give my one and only citation to the congressional record here, 20 HREP number 96-1307, 96 Congress, 2nd Session, 1980. That discussed that the reason Congress was actually putting ex parte reexamination into the law books was to protect the innovator, protect patentees. And the exact quote from this congressional history is, to reduce, if not end, quote, the threat of legal costs being used to blackmail such holders, patent holders, into allowing patent infringements or being forced to license their patents for nominal fees. So there you go. It's a common perception, misperception, that post-grant reviews originated with the idea that we were going to be out there helping accused infringers, but in fact the idea was to strengthen patents and to help patentees get out from blackmail situations. My final comment before I pass the phone line to Adam, Professor Mossoff, is I mentioned at the outset congressional Jenga. We removed de novo review, which we might hear today on this call was one of the structural support rods that allow administrative decisions to have constitutional correctness. We've also added to inter partes review the adversarial nature of it all, a contest before judges. So we've also removed examination. There's a feeling that examination by examiners was something that protected ex parte reexamination and inter partes reexamination from constitutional scrutiny. So now we've got all the control rods or all of the rods of the Jenga tower removed. And let's hear from Adam, Professor Mossoff, who will, I think, speak on the history of our treatment of the patent as the property right.
Thank you, Rob. It's a real pleasure to be on this panel today talking about this really important issue involving the PTAB and the protection of patents as property rights and innovation in this country. This is a very important issue, if only because the PTAB has become, in a few scant years of its existence, an example of executive overreach par excellence. Now, this has occurred in basically two different ways, and both of them are being addressed, and legal challenges have been raised with respect to them. The first is that the PTAB has been engaging in a significant amount of procedural and substantive, well, for lack of a better term, shenanigans. They have not been respecting kind of basic procedural requirements in differentiating instituting panels for reviewing patents as opposed to actually reviewing the panels. They've actually been reconstituting and stacking panels in order to get the outcomes that are desired by the PTAB or by the director. This was brought out recently in oral argument in a colloquy between Judge Toronto and the solicitor from the Patent Office in a case called Yissam. And many, many other examples that have been raised by litigants who've been appealing from the PTAB. The other way that the PTAB is an example of a set of executive overreach par excellence of an administrative state run riot, and I don't use those terms lightly, isn't as very structured as an administrative review tribunal. And this is what I'm going to primarily focus on today, the very existence of the PTAB and whether that raises fundamental concerns and questions regarding the protection of patents as private property rights under the Constitution, as secured repeatedly by the Supreme Court and lower federal courts for well over 200 years. Now, the reason why I'm raising this point is because in a series of decisions coming out of the PTAB, the Federal Circuit, in opinions by Judge Dyke, has repeatedly been holding that, quote, patent rights are public rights, end quote. And it's doing so on the basis of the McCormick decision that Rob just eloquently and clearly discussed. But it's also been reaching this on the basis of citations to modern administrative law cases arising out of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, and other administrative cases, for instance, arising out of the Clean Water Act. Now, this is very important because those cases do not involve property rights, and more importantly, they do not involve private property rights that are secured under the Constitution, under the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, and under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment as well. And this is a very important premise that we have to remember, because the PTAB is not operating on a blank slate. It is, in fact, adjudicating the validity of patents, which have been long recognized as predicate matters in the law as first property rights, and secondly, as private property rights that have been secured under the Constitution. And I have been very honored to have been filing amicus briefs on behalf of law professors in many of these cases, trying to point out this long history that is being ignored by Judge Dyke and others in considering the operations of the PTAB, both in terms of the institution itself, as well as with respect to some of its, as I said, because I have no better term for it, its procedural shenanigans. Now, this point is not shocking, and it's not new even to the U.S. Supreme Court. Just last year, in a case, in a takings case involving the question of whether personal property is secured under the Takings Clause of the Fifth Amendment, Horn v. Department of Agriculture, Chief Justice Roberts quoted from an 1882 decision in James v. Campbell, in which the Supreme Court said, quote, "A patent confers upon the patentee an exclusive property in the patented invention, which cannot be appropriated or used by the government itself without just compensation, any more than it can appropriate or use without compensation land which has been patented to a private purchaser." And this was not a surprising or shocking statement by James v. Campbell in 1882. This followed decades of Supreme Court decisions in McClurg v. Kingsland in 1843, U.S. v. Burns, 1870, Khmer v. Newton in 1876, and McKeever v. United States by the Court of Claims in 1878, where lower federal courts and the Supreme Court held repeatedly that patents are private property rights that are secured under the Constitution as such, tantamount with land and other property rights that have been secured, and that they thus receive the same protection. In effect, patents are not economic regulatory policy to advance innovation, which is the conventional wisdom today among many commentators and among many of my fellow academics, unfortunately. Instead, in fact, patents are property rights, a point that Congress itself ratified and codified in the 1952 Patent Act in Section 261, and it was done explicitly on the grounds that it was codifying this long tradition of the Supreme Court and federal courts securing patents as property rights and providing them constitutional protections as such, which is an important framework for understanding what we're trying to assess and the significance of what we're trying to discuss when we talk about what's happening at the PTAB with respect to these property rights. Now, in order to keep my opening remarks short, I'm now going to conclude and hand the telephone off to Tejinder, who's going to talk about some of the cases raising some of these constitutional concerns with respect to the PTAB. Tejinder?
Yeah, thanks so much, Adam, and thanks so much, everyone else, for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to be here. So by way of a little bit of background, you know, I am not a patent attorney, nor am I a learned scholar of the history of patent rights. I'm a Supreme Court litigator, and I represent a company called MCM Portfolio, which has filed a petition for a writ of certiorari seeking the Supreme Court's review of a Federal Circuit decision upholding the constitutionality of IPR. Rob represents Charles Cooper, who's filed a parallel petition in a similar case. And our argument basically is that IPR is unconstitutional because it violates both Article 3 of the United States Constitution, which vests the judicial power of the United States only in Article 3 courts and not in executive agencies or anywhere else. In our case, we make the further argument that it violates the Seventh Amendment, which provides a right to a trial by jury in civil cases where the amount of controversy exceeds $20. And so, what I'd like to do in sort of talking about this is tell you a little bit about how the legal arguments and doctrines in these cases play out against the backdrop of what you've already heard from my co-panelists, and then talk a little bit about how what the Supreme Court did recently in the Kuza Speed Technologies case interacts with what we're doing. So in broad strokes, our argument is this procedure takes the judicial power, that is the power to adjudicate valuable private property rights, which is part of the judicial power, and it puts it somewhere other than an Article III court, and that's not allowed. And there's a long line of cases basically saying this, saying that, you know, Article III vests judicial power only in the courts, and with very, very limited exceptions, you cannot vest it elsewhere. The limited exception that the lower courts found applicable, and that the respondents in our case, and in our case the respondents are both HP and the federal, Hewlett-Packard and the federal government, have said applies, is an exception for what's called public rights. And the best place to go if you want to learn more about sort of the history of the public rights exception is the Supreme Court's 2011 case Stern versus Marshall, and this is a case that arose in the bankruptcy context. So basically, public rights exception acknowledges that there are a certain narrow category of rights that are not like traditional private rights, but are instead so tied up with executive or legislative powers that they can be adjudicated in an executive or a legislative forum. They can also be adjudicated in courts, but Congress is free to have them adjudicated elsewhere. And the respondents in our case argue that patents are in that category of rights. And whether they are or not is actually a rather tricky question to resolve, because the public rights exception, it's fair to say, is a total mess. And the law surrounding it is very unclear about exactly how you apply it. There are sort of two different lines of reasoning that courts have applied to determine whether a right is a public right. The original reasoning was public rights are those rights that you can assert kind of only against the government, you know, as against the sovereign and its citizens, what are those rights? But that conception has been abandoned and subsequently broadened. And so now the two kind of lines of reasoning, one is what I'll call a historic test, and this is the one we push. There is language in many Supreme Court decisions that basically says that if a right is the type of right that was adjudicated in courts of law or equity or admiralty, you know, going back to the time of the founding, then it is a quintessential private right, and you cannot take it out of the courts. And that's why everything that Adam just said is super relevant to what we're doing in the Supreme Court, because we believe that patent rights have always been adjudicated principally in the courts, going back even to before the time of the founding to English practice. You know, it was very common to adjudicate the validity of patents in court. And so under this historic test, we think we are clearly correct that patents are private rights, not public rights. The second line of inquiry, though, is what I'll call a practical test. So there are statements in some of the court's cases saying that if a right is sort of intertwined with a federal regulatory scheme, and if the adjudication is designed to deal with a specific limited aspect of that regulatory scheme, then it could be a public right. And so the other side in our case argues, well, that's exactly what's going on here. The PTAB is merely correcting errors in the examination process. You know, this is just all part and parcel of the federal government's power to issue patents. That is a statute. Patents are a statutory right. They exist only by virtue of statute. This regulatory scheme sort of covers everything. And what's really unclear is, you know, assume for a moment that they're right about that. You know, what that means is that the two different articulations of the public rights exception test are producing different results. In Stern, the Supreme Court kind of recited all of these various possible conceptions of the public rights test, but it never told us which one is the correct one. And so the cases that are, if they could produce different results. In Stern, the claim at issue was a state law counterclaim, and so the result was the same no matter what kind of test you applied. It was a private right no matter what. And so the court has not gotten into, you know, how to resolve this tension into these tests. And that's something that we're really hoping that the court will resolve, because that issue will be tremendously important for patents, but also for all other manner of claims of public or private right. Before I pass off, I just want to say one brief word about the Supreme Court's recent decision in Cuso. So recently the Supreme Court decided that very statutory questions relating to IPR. And in that case, the court held that the way IPR is set up is okay under the statute. Now, that doesn't address the constitutional questions that we're raising, but some of the statements in the Couso opinion do shed some light on how the justices think about IPR. And they suggest that the justices are looking at IPR in a way that is basically, as I described, kind of a continuation of the prior reexamination regime. We think that's wrong because, as Rob pointed out, there's this sort of congressional game of Jenga where in every step it gets a little more hostile to patentees' rights. It gets a little more like litigation by other means. And so there are real concerns. But we also think that even if that is true, the historic test nevertheless dictates the outcome that this is unconstitutional. And the prior reexamination regime may also have been unconstitutional. And so it may have to be the case that Congress actually has to come up with an entirely different way of dealing with, you know, dealing with bad patents. And we have some suggestions for how Congress could do it. Obviously, none of them are mandatory. But there are ways to get around this problem without relegating the adjudication to an executive forum. So that's just a little bit about how these cases are going. And I think, you know, we're going to chat a little bit, and then we can have questions from you all. And if you want any more information from any of us, we've got it.
All right. Thank you, Tejinder. Before we open up the lines to the audience, I'd like to give each of our panelists a chance to make any comments on the other speaker's remarks, or perhaps add a postscript to his own remarks of anything that you didn't get a chance to say. Gentlemen, who'd like to chime in first?
Well, perhaps we should go in order. So this is Rob Greenspoon again. Just very quickly, reflecting off of something Adam said about cooking the outcome at the USPTO. Well, since I practiced before the PTAB, I am not going to say that on a public telephone conference. However, I will say that my observations of the PTAB in action are that they really do come from a culture where they believe the legislation that gave them their jobs as employees of the executive, not subject to the protections, obviously, of Article III judges, but the legislation that gave them their jobs requires them to, when in doubt, find patents invalid. I mean, that's just the culture of the PTAB, and I think folks who are former APJs have kind of acknowledged this in private, that, you know, when you sit around the snack room or whatever functions as the snack room at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, you know, you get your props from your community by showing that you've been really tough on patents. Now, contrast that with the general attitude of the federal bench about really any complicated litigation. The general attitude of the federal bench is you have to really move a federal judge off of the idea that it's the jury's job to decide a question. Judges want juries to decide questions. They want black box juries because, you know, for a federal judge, they respect juries for one thing, but also when the jury comes to a resolution, it's more or less immune from overturning on appeal. We all know there are exceptions to that, but you get the final resolution of a complex case when a jury makes the decision, and so there's humility on the part of a federal judge when approaching detailed, complex factual situations that you might face in the validity dispute. So that's the contrast. The culture at the PTAB of believing that you're not doing your job unless you're invalidating patents on the one hand, and the attitude of humility on the part of the federal bench when it comes to complex litigation. And that's my comment.
Sure. Adam?
Two quick points. First is also to reiterate Rob's point, because just to make clear that this is not just something that he may have heard. I have heard the exact same things. What everyone else would call ALJs, Ministry of Law Judges, and they call ALPs at the PTO, that, you know, they see their job as invalidating patents, as sweeping the system from bad patents. And in fact, they're very much publicly on the record on these issues too. If many people remember in the patent space, Chief Judge Rader's heated rhetoric when he referred to the PTAB as a death squad. But then Chief Judge Smith of the PTAB publicly said, "Yes, we are. That is our statutory mandate. Our job is to kill patents." And so this is very much part of the culture of the PTAB. And and that leads into my second point, which is that is that this is exactly why you need the types of procedural and structural protections as well as substantive protections that the Constitution provides. Because we are today in the midst of, for lack of a better term, a moral panic about the patent system and in the policy debates in DC and elsewhere. And you have the Supreme Court handing down very unclear doctrine that has been, particularly in the area of patentable subject matter, which has been exploited by people caught up in this moral panic to engage in excessively high kill rates on patents and validating legitimate patented innovation across the board. And I believe that this is an environment that the PTAB has gotten caught up in as well, and unfortunately is using to justify my own heavy-handed rhetoric when I refer to what they're engaging in as shenanigans. I don't believe that they are, that they have bad will or bad ill intent. I think that they really do. These are people who are really trying to do their jobs and do them correctly. I just believe that they have not been given appropriate substantive restraints, and they, for various reasons, unintended reasons from the AIA, they don't believe that they have structural restraints imposed upon them. And so I think that this is what happens when you have executive agencies that are not restrained. You get out of control behavior, even when it may not be intended, and even when it's well intentioned by the members of that agency.
The gender?
Yeah, I don't have that much to add. I'd love to hear what folks have to say in terms of questions. But on this point about moral panic, I do think that it has, to some degree, gone into the federal bench as well. I think we're seeing, there is this sort of like narrative, which only now I think folks are starting to chip away at it, but there's this narrative of patent trolls are a really huge problem. And without a doubt, there are a few bad actors in the patent space. On the flip side, there are tons of non-practicing entities, inventors, universities, you name it, who have make really wonderful contributions to the innovation economy, who stand to lose a lot here. And then on the other hand of that, there are folks who I think the AIA never really intended to benefit who are reaping rewards, right? One of the most famous examples is hedge funds, right? So Kyle Bass started a little cottage industry of just bringing PTAB challenges so that he could short the stock of the companies that hold the patents. And so I think it is true that, as a policy matter, this kind of narrative that's taken hold of the way we talk about patents has led to, at least arguably a policy overreaction, or certainly, a set of policies that have with them the flavor that they are supposed to be killing patents. And, I'm not sure that the implications have always been exactly what would be best for the economy.
Thank you. We'll ask now Dean Reuter to open up the lines. Callers, you can hit *# on your telephone to enter the queue for questions and answers. Those will get queued up. If you want to address your question to a particular panelist, you're welcome to do so, but we will leave any and all questions open to all three of our panelists to comment on as they will. I thank very much each of Tejinder, Adam, and Rob for their comments. Even though I've been practicing in this area and intently involved with clients, it's always interesting to hear different perspectives, and I always learn new things and get new color put into this. So with that, we'll ask Dean to open up the lines and start taking questions.
Terrific. Just hold on until the... So as Trevor Copeland mentioned, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone to ask a question. Before we go to the floor, Trevor, with your indulgence, let me make a quick commercial announcement about our upcoming schedule next week. On Tuesday at 3 o'clock, we will be discussing church playgrounds and the Blaine Amendment. That's the funding of church playgrounds across the country. And the Blaine Amendments, those are some interesting state constitutional amendments. You can learn more about those Tuesday at 3. And then to round out the week, we have on Wednesday a new book, The Intimidation Game by Wall Street Journal author Kim Strassel. She'll be joining us Wednesday. Thursday, we'll be talking about new changes to the rules of discovery. And then Friday, we'll be talking about China's difficulties in arbitration at The Hague. Today, of course, we're talking about the America Invents Act. We've got plenty of time left for questions. We've got one question on the line. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Now we've got four questions, so we will get to these questions in turn. Let's take our first call of the day.
I have only done one of these, and I had the impression that the board did not want to hear about secondary considerations. And they allowed the other side to promise to give me a protective order that would allow us to use depositions that had been taken in the court case that began prior to the defendant initiating the IPR. And rather than give us more time to develop the evidence from another direction or ordering a protective order, the board simply said, no, you're not going to get any more time. Do what you can with this. And gave no guidance on the protective order and basically shut down the fact that the patent had been completely copied by the infringer to every detail, and that the commercial success of the item is what caused them to copy this very specific design. I don't think a court would have done that. A court, given more time in the proceeding, would have simply said,
"So."
And
I understand the facts you're setting up. Do you have a question?
Yeah, has the lack of secondary consideration, or is there some huge bias, or is this unique to this panel? Against considering things like secondary considerations that show non-obviousness.
Right. I'll toss that one to Rob. Rob, you've been before the PTAB in a number of cases. Have you seen anything particular pro-con or in between that the PTAB does with regard to secondary consideration arguments?
Yeah, I think that there's a feeling, and this reflects that feeling, and it's really proven empirically, that the PTAB has procedural thumbs on the scales. In other words, in order to sort of speed things along and to satisfy perhaps this mandate to invalidate patents, they will take a patentee's reasonable request for a certain amount of discovery, and they'll sort of move the goalposts in terms of the standards that they're applying in order just to grant you the procedural opportunities that you need. So I joke with my wife that I'm not even kidding. There is a process where you send an email requesting permission to have leave to file a motion for leave to do something procedural. I mean, there's like four levels of indirection there. But the upshot is if you are a patentee trying to develop your proofs, first of all, the 1 year time frame has serious due process concerns behind it just right out of the gate. But secondly, the way it's being implemented is really, really almost criminal in the mind of many practitioners who represent patent owners.
Okay. Thank you. Next question, please.
Just a quick note that we have three questions pending, Trevor. Again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Paul Johnson in Los Angeles. I'm a general appellate lawyer, and I'm distressed to hear about what's happening with the PTAB. Back in the late 90s, the problem I perceived was that patent holders had a very difficult time going up against well-heeled, established infringers, and that they were misusing the jury process for de novo review of decisions that examiners had already made. And at that time, I was arguing for deference to the administrative decisions, for example, where an obviousness question based on the same prior art had already been before the examiner. But you know, that had its own set of problems. And it's distressing to hear that moving it inside the umbrella of the PTO doesn't seem to be any improvement.
Sure. Did you have a question you wanted to address to one of our panelists from your perspective in a more general appellate background?
Yes. Well, I guess the question is, I think that Adam, maybe you're the one who suggested that there are alternatives here, what do we do to fix this? Obviously, there has to be some type of available review of validity determinations, but what's the alternative to de novo jury trials over issues that have been decided by the examiners?
Maybe that was Tejender who, this is Rob.
Tejender,
sorry, yes, who did.
I think that's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, all of us might have opinions about what the best alternative would be. You know, some of the alternatives we've suggested include, for example, you know, you could have something like a PR, but have the result be sort of purely advisory, and then have the actual validity of the property right adjudicated in court. You know, whether that addresses the types of problems you're talking about or not, right? Because you flagged what you perceived to be an issue with the prior system under which you had litigation, right? And really what you flagged was really a problem that will probably manifest everywhere, right? Which is when you have big company versus small company, a big company has an advantage. That's just always going to be true. I'm not sure that that solves all the problems, but it would address the constitutional problem, which is kind of what we've been focused on in the papers we've been filing. You know, there are other things that could be done. You know, you could think about, changing procedures to issue patents in the first instance, right? If the problem is bad patent quality, and it's especially been highlighted in areas like software, you know, then maybe what the PTO needs to do is not create a mechanism that messes with vested property rights, but needs to be more careful about doling out patents for certain kinds of technologies and reexamine those procedures. There's other possibilities as well. You know, you could consider who's appointed to district courts. You could have Article III courts that have a patent specialty. You know, there are all kinds of options that theoretically could be better and constitutional. We can all use our imaginations, I think, and folks who have practiced in this area and thought about it a lot probably have lots of great ideas.
Sure. This is Trevor. I'm going to step in with moderator's privilege and follow up on that. I think Tejender definitely is looking the right direction for this. And one of the things that we have to, I think, take into account is the law is not particularly quick and agile with regard to change. There is a parallel, what we might call bad, or at least big bubbles of bad patents that parallel the tech bubble of the mid to late 90s, where the PTO, with the boom in advancing computer technology, computer-based and computer-related business methods, many of the examiners were not well-trained. Many of them were used to just searching patent prior art, and so non-patent prior art, there were not great search tools and resources, and to the extent that resources were available, they just weren't used, which means a lot of patents issued in that time that had claims that probably shouldn't have had the examination been done as stringently as, for example, it is now being done, particularly after the reforms within the Patent Office training and staffing over the last several years. And so if we kind of acknowledge that there's a bit of a historical anomaly where there was a lag in administrative procedure implementation for a few years, just say, okay, you know, we don't exactly get a do-over, but let's not have the alleged solution be worse than the problem that it engendered it. Very much appreciate the good question and follow-up comments. Our time's going to be winding down here before too long. Let's move on to the next question, please.
Thank you, Trevor. Here we go.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And JPODS, Hyperloop, and a number of other transportation network innovators have a number of patents that we will end up having to sue the federal government and locals and state governments to get access to rights of way to exercise these patentable configurations. I'd like to figure out from the moderators or the presenters who would be the best people to create a framework or talk to about creating a framework for suing under these patent rights.
It's a little outside the scope of today's panel, but given the brain trust we have among our panelists, I'll open it up if anybody wants to jump in and comment on that one. No takers?
No, it's too far outside the scope of our current discussion today.
Yeah, that's I apologize, but that's there are a lot of other tangled and tangential issues that would get into that we're not really prepared to discuss today. I do appreciate you participating in the panel, though. Let's move to the next question, please.
We have just one question pending. Might have time for a second question if you'd like to be that questioner. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, this is Matthew Dowd. I'm a partner at Andrews Kurth, and I do a fair amount of patent litigation and appellate work. Thanks for talking about this issue today. It's a great topic, and so I appreciate your time. I have a question about the implications if the court agrees with the position that these patent rights are private rights, and specifically, how does that affect the ability to litigate patents in Article I tribunals such as the ITC and the Court of Federal Claims? And to what extent does that issue play into or will affect the court's thinking on this issue? And from a practical matter, do you think that will this whole issue about litigating patents in before the Court of Federal Claims and the ITC will affect or either positively or negatively the outcome of the appeal from your perspective?
This is Rob. I'll step in, and perhaps each of us will have a perspective on this. That's a very interesting question. The Court of Federal Claims is established specifically as the vehicle by which the government waives sovereign immunity. So you would never have any rights to sue the government for infringement if they didn't waive sovereign immunity by establishing a court like that. So it has its own very tortuous sort of constitutional analysis for anything that it does. My impression is that the Court of Federal Claims, as well as the ITC, they're each, to one degree or another, kept cabined within the framework that we're talking about. I think we would be, as a panel, we would be hard-pressed to find the same constitutional defects in those courts. For one thing, in the ITC at least, not sure about the Court of Federal Claims, but in the ITC, if there's an outcome there in either direction, it cannot be used as collateral estoppel in a later or co-pending federal court action. So the remedy in the ITC is stopping infringement at the border. So that's as far as it goes. If you lose your patent based on an invalidity rationale, that doesn't directly translate into collateral estoppel as if you had lost in a federal court. So for the other complexities of your question, I think I'll pass to the other panelists.
This is Adam, and I would just second much of what Rob just said. The creation of the Federal Court of Claims in the 19th century, and the later creation of the ITC in the 20th century, really reflected, I think, a concern and a respect for the basic rights of property and contract that these institutions would be adjudicating disputes over. And so they provide extensive procedural protections and procedural requirements that are balanced, that reflect, although aren't necessarily identical to, but reflect the same type of balanced procedural requirements that are imposed upon both plaintiffs and defendants in an Article III court, which is why these institutions have been legitimately exercising their authority as Article I courts for the time that they have been. And I believe that this goes to the heart of what we've been talking about on this panel, and it really goes to the heart of what happened in the American Vents Act when they enacted it in 2011, which is that it's a fundamentally unbalanced institution. In fact, I was on the Hill doing staffer briefings in the policy debates leading up to the enactment of 2011, and I was remarking on this to congressional staffers. I kept saying to them, you are committing a Nirvana fallacy here. You think that, that the problem is that there's bad patents, and so you're creating an institution to eliminate some bad patents, and you think this institution is going to work perfectly. You don't think it's going to be abused. You don't think it's going to be captured. You don't think that people within it are going to have a misperception of what their role is as an administrative law judge whose job is to hear the legitimate rights of rights owners under the Constitution with respect to property rights. And their response was to just kind of look at me blankly and say, but there's a problem with bad patents and we need to clear out these clogs in the machinery of the innovation economy. And I said, that's great, but tell me one institution that works in the way that works perfectly without there being in structural constraints imposed upon it to ensure even balanced treatment of all sides, both claimants and defendants or respondents, in every case.
Adam, go ahead. I have a question for you myself.
Yeah, so I felt very much I've analogized myself to Cassandra. It was like saying, there's a problem here. No one would listen. And what we're seeing now, 5 years later, is exactly this problem. That if you look at in the AIA, all of the statutory content is directed to reviewing patents for their invalidity, which is where Chief Judge Smith and the ALJs today get the impression that their mandate is to be a death squad. It's not entirely crazy, but and this is exactly why you need to recognize that the Constitution, therefore, is the backstop. Congress can't pass legislation that is unconstitutional when it doesn't provide appropriate procedural and substantive protections under the relevant provisions that apply to private property rights, which is what patents are.
Adam, this is Rob again. Have you, or maybe it's another academic, have you written on the self-censorship, if you will, of accused infringers? That is, in federal court, an accused infringer has to not make every argument for the breadth of a patent claim, because if they do so, that risks stinging them on the infringement case, but they don't have those shackles on themselves in the PTAB. Is that something that you've talked about?
I've talked about it orally. I believe that is something that Professor Greg Dolan, a patent law professor at Baltimore, has written on. He has published some articles on the creation of the PTAB and the procedural and substantive infirmities that were built into the very structure of it in the fact that it was unbalanced, that it imposed all of the substantive burdens and prohibitions on the patent owners, and it didn't impose any equal restraints or burdens on the challengers, which creates an asymmetrical system where it's completely at the risk of the patent owners and there's zero risk held by the challengers.
Okay, I think that about wraps up our time. Thank you very much, Adam, Tejinder, and Rob. Thank you to each of our audience members, and we very much appreciate your time and participation today.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. Let me join you, Trevor, in thanking the others and also thanking you. This has been a terrific discussion. I want to thank the audience as well. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleform conference call is Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on this same number. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.